Honor.
Mr. Good. Yes, we can hear you just fine. Please proceed.
Great. Ryan McBride on behalf of Casaroni Law Group and appellant Christina Perrickman. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if possible.
Okay.
So the main issue in this appeal is whether the appellant sufficiently alleged the September 12, 2019 collection letter in the complaint. The Ninth Circuit and the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, specifically Federal Rule 8, provide for liberal pleading standards. And in preparation for this argument today, there seem to be two district court cases that really hit the nail on the head here. They found that when looking at sufficiency of the complaint, the court should look at the pleadings as a whole, especially when the complaint incorporates preceding paragraphs of the complaint.
I don't want you to waste your time, but I have to talk to you about something preliminary, and that is whether or not the district court didn't commit a significant error under Rule 56F, because as I understand it, your client moved a summary judgment against Apria, which responded, and then your client moved almost simultaneously against ARS, which cross-moved, and you never lodged a brief, an argument, or any oral argument for that matter on your claims that you filed under 1692E or 1692F. The district court, correctly or incorrectly, and I know you were just about to talk about that, but to me it doesn't matter, the district court ruled that the defense should win on 1693C and dismiss the entire case. It seems to me that the district court did not permit Ms. Pearson to argue or state any of its positions on standing, on 1692E or 1692F, and therefore did not give your client a reasonable opportunity to be heard on those claims under the federal rule I stated.
Yes, Your Honor, I tend to agree. The E and the F violations were in my opinion, overlooked. We, you know, in a motion for reconsideration, attempted to bring that up regarding the letter violations, and the court said that the letter violations were not sufficiently alleged in the complaint. That was essentially what the order said in the response to the motion for reconsideration.
Right, but the court said nothing about 1692E or 1692F. No one briefed it. No one argued it. And while I recognize that the district court has every right to dismiss and not adjudicate state claims that you brought, it seems that those are significant federal claims under the FDCPA statute that the court never heard from you on.
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely.
But why do we have to talk about any substance if the district court prematurely dismissed the case?
Out of an abundance of caution and to address all the issues that were brought up by the appellee,
do you contend in this court that the unanswered phone calls can be a predicate for a violation of ERF?
No, they were unanswered calls. Therefore, there could not have been a misrepresentation as to the character or amount of the debt or whether it was...
Don't contest that as to the unanswered calls, the district court's ruling saying that that didn't amount to a violation of CE or F is unassailable.
Yes, agreed, yes.
So the only issue is the letter that was raised in the motion for reconsideration where the court said it wasn't pleaded.
Correct.
And
I was going to next go into the complaint and actually just quickly point out, you know, paragraph 33 described.
But I kind of want to understand where we are on this sort of preliminary point about 56F, because as I understand it. So you moved against both defendants, against Opryta and ARS, and then only Opryta filed a cross motion. But Opryta's cross motion, because the state claim is parasitic of the underlying federal claims, briefed the ENF issues and then put you to your proof on ENF. Am I reading that correctly?
Well, only as to the unanswered calls, but yes, they did.
Okay, so as to the unanswered calls, you had the notice and opportunity to be heard that you needed to put in your proof on ENF in the guise of being wrapped around the state law claim, but you were on notice that you were put to your proof and had to come forward with sufficient evidence to create a genuine issue as to ENF buried within that with respect to the unanswered calls. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
That doesn't seem to me to be what your briefing said. You argued in question one of your briefing that you never had an opportunity to be heard or briefed Section 1692E or 1692F of the FDCPA.
Well, I'm sorry.
I don't understand what you're arguing here.
Let me be clear. In count one of our complaint relates only to the unanswered calls and only as to 1692C.
Right. Not 1692 E or F.
I apologize.
You answered Judge Collins' question incorrectly.
I apologize, Your Honor. Yes, that was a miss. I believe. I'm sorry. I was trying to go back through my mind to the MSJs, but E and F only relate as to the other collection actions taken, not as to the unanswered calls. C is the section that relates only to the unanswered calls.
But Opryta's summary judgment motion against you said that it should win because you didn't prove ENF, which is a predicate for the relief on the state law claim against them.
Well, they can, they're entitled to argue the ENF violations, but in particular, they were unanswered calls, and so that there was not a communication made.
Motion that you didn't get noticed, Rule 56 requires that you get notice that you're being told, you're put on your proof, you need to come forward with a genuine issue with respect to a particular issue in the case. And be it in the context of the state claim, Opryta's motion puts you on notice that you had to come forward and create a genuine issue with respect to ENF because it's a predicate of the state claim. Now, if you took back your answer to that question, then I'm very confused, because the Opryta motion clearly puts that issue in play. And so if you're claiming it doesn't, then you need to explain that to me.
Well, the issue that was not put in play was the collection letter.
That I understand.
Okay.
But I thought you were taking back your answer that as to the unanswered communications, the ENF claim was teed up by the Opryta motion in the context of being a predicate for the state claim.
I off the top of my head, I don't particularly, and I can go back and look. The ENF violations under that they were arguing under the unanswered calls, I'm not sure, but I think that may be a moot issue, because the ENF violations that we're talking about now are as to the collection letter. It's a different issue. So even if
you lose, as far as I'm concerned, then you lose, because I think the district court properly dismissed the case under 1692C. But the fact of the matter is, correct me if I'm wrong, you didn't argue 1692E or 1692F either in your briefing or before the district court, and the district court never directed you to do so. They sua sponte. He dismissed those claims sua sponte, correct?
Correct. So, you know, in so the material dispute here, and I just want to, make it clear, the material dispute in our opinion is that the collection letter itself under ENF, you know, it was a violation of ENF, and counts 2 and 3 make that very clear, that those are the two sections that were violated. Count 1 is in regards to C and the unanswered calls. It was a completely separate issue, and the only one that, if you look at the judge's motion for summary judgment order and the motion for reconsideration order, they both only identified that those particular, the unanswered calls. It didn't look at anything else in regards to those violations.
Okay, why don't, you're out of time. Why don't we hear from the other side, and we'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I am June Grace Philippe on behalf of the appellee RSTRAT LLC. I'd like to address the issue on whether or not the District Court allowed Ms. Pearson an opportunity to argue or brief her Sections 1692E or F claims. And RSTRAT says that it was addressed, it was brought up. Ms. Pearson had every opportunity in her motions, in the evidence presented on the summary judgment motions, and there were three, and in her oral argument, which is telling that the court did not have to have oral argument, but he scheduled oral argument to hear all of these motions, and at no point in time did Ms. Pearson raise the letter or even discuss the E or F claim, because what happened in the hearing was, we were discussing unanswered calls, and she proceeded.
Question.
Yes.
I credit your argument. Do you have cases or precedent to guide us, and me in specific, on the question of whether or not the manner in which your clients raised the 1692 E and F claims constitutes, for purposes of Rule 56F, sufficient notice and opportunity for Ms. Pearson to argue those counts before the District Court?
Your Honor, I can't. None comes to mind at this very moment. But
well, it would be nice, right, if we had a case even that said a District Court needn't order briefing and argument on a particular issue to comply with Rule 56F, but rather notice in the form of a summary judgment motion relying on state claims or whatever facts are being moved upon constitutes notice for purpose of that rule, right?
Right, Your Honor. But what Ms. Pearson did is she moved for summary judgment on her entire FDCPA claim.
So very cases from the Ninth Circuit or district courts within it that say that's enough to comply, for a district court to comply with Rule 56F before it sua sponte dismisses the entire case?
She was granted a full opportunity to ventilate the issues.
You say that, but who else has said that? Who that I can look at in sight has said that before?
Not on that particular issue, yeah. Your Honor, I don't have a case specifically. But what is telling here is when she moved for summary judgment on her entire FDCPA claim, although she focused on the C issue, which is that these calls were made before 8 a.m., she was also, Ms. Pearson was also alleging, well, these were calls to collect a debt I didn't owe, her E claim, or to collect a debt that was not owed pursuant to her agreement or by law. It wasn't until the time of the summary judgment motion that was argued, which Arshar brought the argument that unless she answered the calls or knew who was calling, there was no communication. So by the virtue of that, summary judgment was properly granted on behalf of RSTRAT on the C claim, and there could be no evidence on the E or F claim based on those calls because there was no communication. What Ms. Pearson is trying to do here now is revive that FDCPA claim by bringing a new legal theory. Like, let's not forget the letter, which she mentioned in the complaint, and as the district court had observed, it was only to her Rosenthal Act claim, a failure to state the required.
I don't have any problem with that proposition, but the, problem I have with that proposition is that I would have liked for her to have made that particular argument before the district court so that the district court could evaluate it before we have to do so without having heard any. The district court's much closer to the issues and knows the facts, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
How can we possibly rule on that without the benefit of some district court analysis?
Well, we should look at the complaint because that is what Ms. Pearson is now claiming, that an E and F claim was alleged based on this letter.
The letter is clearly in the complaint. I mean, because the letter is mentioned in paragraph 33,
correct.
And then each of the successive causes of action begins with the standard paragraph that it incorporates by reference all previous ones. And then each of them states in very general terms that there was a violation of the particular statutes. So that complaint alleges that the letter is a violation of E and F. So the district court's assertion that plaintiff failed to allege that the letter violated E or F seems to me to be clearly wrong. Tell me why you think I'm wrong.
Well, under the plaintiff did allege incorporated by reference her prior allegations, but it is not on the defendant to deem or figure out which allegations of that were alleged pertain to which claim. That should be clear. We should be put on notice. And that's not what was done here.
Anyone reading this complaint would know that the letter is one of the predicates for the ENF. So the question is whether or not it was made clear enough in the summary judgment papers that the letter was at issue in terms of the ENF aspect of the case. Can you address that?
Well, Your Honor, may I just go back to what was alleged in the complaint? What was alleged in the complaint, at paragraph 3, which is the first time this letter is ever mentioned, is that she received a letter from RSTRAT on September 12, 2019. It states the amount. It says who's the debt for. And then the very next paragraph subsequent to that is, this letter did not contain the Section 1812-700 of statutory disclosure. After that, she talks about she called.
So are you saying that means that's the only violation it states is the 1817?
Yes, that's the only.
That's not a reasonable reading of this. I mean, paragraph 33, after the whole complaint is that the debt is bad. And then paragraph 33 says, I got a letter stating that this debt was owed. And on information and belief, it's the same debt that I've just said is bad. So it's a letter about a bad debt is the reasonable way to read this complaint.
This sort of seems sort of almost like looking back in hindsight. Because in her fourth claim, she mentions, again, she wouldn't have had to, but she actually alleges this letter failed to state this 1812-700 claim separately. And she does not do it on her first, second, or third claim. In fact, the second claim under E, it's a conclusory statement. It's almost a resuscitation of what E is. Collecting or a misleading statement, a failure, a false statement, misrepresentation. Doesn't say what it is, but we do know in the first claim, she's talking about these calls before 8 a.m. And if we go to the allegations right before that, she sets forth how many calls she received from RSTRAT on a specific date. She doesn't mention the letter at all. The district court, it's not that the district court missed it or I missed it, it's the fact that it was not alleged.
Well, when you moved, when the motion was filed by Apria that included the ENF predicates, did that motion raise the issue of whether there was a sufficient communication for purposes of ENF?
Apria is a separate defendant, Your Honor, and there were separate letters or separate bills that Apria sent to Ms. Pearson that RSTRAT took no involvement in. Our communications with Ms. Pearson were specifically these unanswered calls, the one letter that we are discussing here today, and after getting these, not answering these calls, she called RSTRAT to find out why were they calling. And she alleges in that conversation, it was a call that, it was a debt that she did not owe. Again, her ENF claims only pertain to calls. It's not clear, and it should be clear, if she was claiming an ENF claim based on a letter.
district court ever make any determination of the plaintiff's standing to sue your clients on these claims?
On the letter, Your Honor, because... No, the court, well, the court did not address standing on any of these claims that I can recall. And so, again, unless it was clearly alleged in the complaint, and again, it was not raised in summary judgment motions, it was not raised in argument. The first time it was raised was in a motion for reconsideration. There, the court, the district court, again, had pointed out it was not alleged, the letter was not alleged as to the FDCPA claim.
The district court had no authority to make any determinations, any of these claims, if the plaintiffs didn't have standing to sue. Right? That's a threshold question, isn't it?
You're right, Your Honor. Standing is always a threshold question.
So why didn't the district court analyze those arguments that you made?
Those arguments on standing,
yeah.
It wasn't raised until, well, the issue...
You said the district court didn't rule on any of them.
On standing issue,
right.
That's correct.
Right.
So if there
you
is...
You can't adjudicate claims as a district court if a plaintiff doesn't have standing to bring them, correct?
Correct. So then plaintiff's lawsuits should still be dismissed for a lack of standing.
No. That's never been adjudicated by anybody, and we're not going to look at that for the first time here. The court clearly violated 56F by not giving the plaintiff an opportunity to respond to your arguments on standing, which it should have looked at before it looked at anything else. We have nothing on that issue from the district court, from the plaintiff, or from anybody except your client, correct?
Correct.
Okay. A concluding statement, because you're over your time.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Our strat contends that the letter was not properly alleged in the complaint, and it was only raised post-summary judgment in a motion for reconsideration and now an appeal to open up an FDCPA claim that has been decided and been dismissed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's put a minute on the clock for rebuttal, please.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors. Just real quickly, I think as the court noted, the Article III standing issue and also the materiality issue that was brought up by Appelli was not decided at the district court level. I don't believe it was even brought up by Appelli at the district court level. So, that's something that the district court, I think, would need to look at. As the court has said, I think it was properly alleged in the complaint, and appellant has not had a proper chance to have it heard by the court. The ENF violations for the letter. This is, in my opinion, a due process issue. And the first time, again, that we could have brought this up as an issue because it was a material dispute of fact was in the motion for reconsideration after the complaint. We believe that it was properly pled, and we ask the court to reverse the ruling. Thank you very much for your time today.
Okay. Thank you very much for your argument. The case just argued is submitted.